Hello and welcome. I am your co-host today, Siobhan Sarna, founder of SIBO SOS and the author of these books. That's the Polish version right there of Healing SIBO. I'm very proud. And I also have my fellow co-host, Dr. Allison Seebecker here. She is one of the leading advocates for connecting medical doctors with naturopaths, with patients on SIBO and EMO. Her site is SIBOinfo.com. We have co-created courses together for the patient population, SIBO Recovery Roadmap, and she's created a beautiful professional course called the SIBO Pro Course. And our star today is Dr. Mark Pimentel, who's going to be bringing us in this annual tradition, an update from Digestive Disease Week, also known as DDW. This is 2023, where he has the foundation of his work, as well as the newest research. And when I say the foundation of his work, you know, no pressure, Dr. Pimentel, but if anyone's going to find a cause for SIBO, EMO, and IBS, we know it's you.
And you need this cure.
We need a cure, darn it.
That's what he's working on.
Yeah. That's right. He's coming in hot from Cedars-Sinai and the Medically Associated Science and Technology program right now, where he works with a brilliant team, helping to solve the problems and rebalancing ultimately the microbiome. So because of this work that he's devoted his life to, he's the one who has developed the first blood test for irritable bowel syndrome and its connection to food poisoning. He's the one who's made in the team a discovery of rifaximin as a treatment for IBS, SIBO, EMO, and describing the relationship between IBS and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and intestinal methanogen overgrowth, determining the relationship of IBS and SIBO as an autoimmune condition. And then also, of course, the one who has created the three gas breath test from Gemelli Labs, the TrioSmart test. So those are just a few of the things he's been up to with his team.
Yeah, you left out like 15 at least.
Yeah, not exactly. 20. So it's okay. Great to have you.
Monumental discoveries. So thank you, Dr. Pimentel.
Thank you so much for being here and for all your good work. I'm going to hand things over to you, sir, so we can dive in.
I'm excited. Let me go ahead and share my screen and let's get going.
So your background there is exactly at the MASS program, right? In California. Right.
If you look way back, I don't know if you can see my mouse now. But if you look way back here, there's a glass, and behind there is the laboratory. Back here where there's these carrels, there, that's where the clinical team sits. I told them to behave themselves, so they may not move around that much today because they're in the background, but it's usually pretty busy back there as well. So this is our office. It's not a faux backdrop. This is the real deal. So hopefully you can see my screen. Can you?
Yes, we can. Perfect. And I'm going to hide my camera and mic, and we'll see on the other side.
All right, sounds good. Well, thank you for allowing me to present and inviting me to present the updates from DDW in context of the work that we've been doing here. I sort of reviewed the last presentation I did, and to some extent it's similar. For those of you who've seen this presentation, you're going to say, "Well, he's talking about the same things again." I am actually not. As you'll see, we have at least 20 new slides in this because so much has happened. But the base information, the foundations of the work, are the foundations of the work. And what I want you to understand is if you listened last year or previously, and then you listen now, you will see how what's been built on the foundation, because you now can understand what the foundation looks like and then the new things and how they plug into this puzzle as the puzzle's coming together more and more. So if it's boring because you've seen it before, believe me, it won't be boring later. So we'll get through to it. As I mentioned in some of our, you know, pre-loading the slide discussion here, the MASS program is behind me here. And this is what we do. We're trying to develop the things that patients need. And to a great extent, what we try to incorporate in everything we do, and I don't talk about it in my slides, but I think it's worth noting, everything we try to do tries to also reduce healthcare costs in the spaces we're working in. And we've done cost analyses for the breath testing, for the blood testing, for the drugs that we try to develop to show that if you find IBS and SIBO early and treat it sooner rather than going through a shenanigans of testing, you're going to save money and save healthcare costs. And I've seen too many times patients come to me after 5 or 6 or 10 year journey of $20,000 in copays when they might have been able to make an assessment and understand their illness sooner, whatever that illness is. And so I think all of this is really important to understand. I want to take you back. This is a new slide. Circa 1996, this is about when I started or started fellowship here at Cedars. You know, this is what we thought of IBS or what the field thought of IBS. There were no FDA approved drugs at that time. So maybe it's early life trauma, maybe it's anxiety, maybe it's depression. IBS was a disease of women. That was what people thought. This is a literal quote from a physician. IBS is a disease of hysterical women. Literally a quote. Shocking, right? And IBS was a diagnosis of exclusion. So you applied the Rome criteria, but you had to have nothing else. So it's a diagnosis of exclusion. So it's a wastebasket diagnosis. And then these are the things that people were trying. There were studies that show some benefit to psychological therapies, antidepressants, antispasmodics, antidiarrheals, laxatives for constipated patients. And that was it. So if you're IBS, if you're constipated, you take a laxative. If you're diarrhea, you take an antidiarrheal or maybe a tricyclic antidepressant. And that was the story. And that has been a story for some people, even to today, those who don't, you know, listen to the new developments because there are a lot of new developments. But I pause on this a little bit because in some of the guidelines for IBS, even today, the guidelines say, well, use an antidiarrheal for IBS. And why? Because it's safe and it's inexpensive. And the answer to that is, yes, it's safe and it's inexpensive. And I just finished saying inexpensive is good. But an antidiarrheal you're taking chronically. Can you imagine a guideline for Crohn's disease where the first line therapy is an antidiarrheal drug? It would be heresy in the Crohn's space because, yes, an antidiarrheal would make the Crohn's diarrhea better, but it's not treating the illness. And yet here we are still in 2023. Well, we recommend an antidiarrheal first because it's cheap and it stops the diarrhea rather than focusing on treating the cause. I like starting with this point because I think you have to understand how physicians still think and the guidances by the societies still in some ways promote not a treatment for causes of IBS, but rather symptom improvement only, which is shocking. So as you've seen this slide before, maybe you haven't, but this is what we're going to cover, but we're going to cover it in a much more greater detail because we have so much more information. So you can see here that it all starts with food poisoning. On the diarrhea side of IBS. So you get sick, you went on a vacation to some country and then you ate some bad food, you got diarrhea, and then ever since then, your bowels have never been or never returned to normal. And we've identified the toxin that we think is causing this cascade. We've identified that creates autoimmunity to a protein that is you called vinculin, as you'll see, and that changes the nerve function of the gut. So the small bowel nerve function is diminished. You get a reduction in these special cleaning waves of the gut. And if you don't clean your gut, it's like eating off your plate without ever putting it in the dishwasher over and over. You get a buildup of bacteria on that plate, or in this case, the small bowel, and you get bacterial overgrowth. And I'll show you all the evidence for that, and particularly excited about the new depth in which we now understand SIBO. And then, of course, you treat it, an antibiotic, rifaximin, is the only FDA-approved, well, it is the only antibiotic that's FDA-approved, but it is FDA-approved for IBS, so that's pretty exciting. So let's start here on the left, which is E. coli, C. jejuni, Shigella, Salmonella. They can all cause IBS, but what's the evidence like the primary evidence that food poisoning leads to IBS. Really one study. It breaks down to this one study by the Mayo Clinic. And if you look at the top are bacterial causes. And 1 in 9 people who experience food poisoning will develop irritable bowel syndrome. And so in 2023, 2017, this paper, it's very clear food poisoning precipitates irritable bowel syndrome, full stop. Okay, so now we have to figure out how that works, why that happens. Now, what I want to explain to you before we get into this is that this happens to explain possibly or probably about 60% of IBS. Remember at the beginning I said IBS is a diagnosis of exclusion historically. So you do a scope, you don't find anything. You do some blood tests, you don't find anything. Okay, it's IBS. So if you take leftovers and you put them in a bin, you know that some of them could be a SIBO, as we're going to talk about. Some of those patients could be celiac patients or EDS patients or various other diseases. So we never believe that SIBO and post-infectious IBS is the cause of all of IBS, because IBS is just whatever's left. But to account for 60%, that's a big, big thing. So here we go. Can AGE, acute gastroenteritis, cause SIBO or IBS? And the answer is yes. So putting this together, we did an animal study, and this was all the way back in 2008. We were already thinking about this. I have a lot of fun stories about the CDTB toxin, which I don't want to waste your time, but really cute and fun, interesting stories about how we thought about CDTB toxin and got to that. But Campylobacter on the right, given to rats, on the left, placebo to rats. Of course, the rats got sick. They completely recovered after about a month, and then we made it 3 more months. So the total study is 4 months. And then we were able to see that the rats who received Campylobacter, now 27% of them have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, whether it's duodenum or jejunum or ileum. So that's the first part of the small bowel, second part of the small bowel, third part of the small bowel. That's what duodenum, jejunum, and ileum mean. But 27% have overgrowth now. Not only is that true, but if you focus on the purple column on the far right, you can see that if you got Campylobacter, which is C+, that's the food poisoning, and that Campylobacter caused the rat to have SIBO, which is the SIBO+, those rats, 84-85% of them, had altered bowel pattern. And they also had increased rectal lymphocytes, which is what we see in humans with post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome. So we had an animal model for the first time where it mimicked what we see in humans with a organism or a bacteria, Campylobacter, which is a form of food poisoning, that is the most common form of food poisoning in the United States. So now we have a working model where we can start to dissect and figure out, okay, what's going on here? But what's going on here now, 2008 to 2022, 14 years later, I'm not going to go over all the studies because it's way too much for this presentation. I will just go over this slide, which sums it all up. This is called the Bradford Hill criteria. The Bradford Hill criteria is a very strict set of guidelines on cause and effect when it comes to diseases caused by bacteria. So the question posed to the Bradford Hill criteria, is there enough evidence to say Campylobacter causes IBS as one of the pathogens? And it meets all the criteria, which is not easy to do. And so this was published in 2022 in Pathogens and Disease, and clearly Campylobacter causes irritable bowel syndrome. But how? How does that work? And this is where the toxin CDTB comes into play and how it's affecting you and making you produce an antibody to yourself. Well, I already mentioned that all four of these organisms, Shigella, Salmonella, Campylobacter, E. coli, they're all bad organisms. You travel somewhere or you eat at a bad restaurant and you get food poisoning. These are the kind of bugs that cause disease, acute disease. So you get diarrhea, and then a few days later, it goes away. The bacteria, any of these four, they're gone after a week, let's say, or even a month. You can't find them in your gut anymore, but they did their damage. And part of their damage is with this toxin that they all share. And it's called cytolethal distending toxin B, or CDTB. What CDTB does is it makes you form an antibody to that toxin. But part of that toxin looks like a protein called vinculin, which is in the nerves of your gut. And you can see the vinculin. These are cells. Let me just use my mouse here. The green are the scaffolding of the cell to keep the cells shaped. It's called actin. And at the end of actin is vinculin, which is like a little motor that moves the cell to, you can see the cells kind of reaching out to grab onto the next one to attach. So if the vinculin doesn't work well, the wires can't connect to each other. And I think that's the best way to describe what happens if you mess with vinculin and you have this antibody, which I'll show you in a minute. So what's happening is that these cells, I know I showed you sort of cells this way, but now we're looking at them in a little bit of a different way. These are the cells, the brown ones, that are called interstitial cells of Cajal. You don't need to remember that. You just need to know that these cells are what make the cleaning waves of the gut go. And they need to be connected. So they need to be close to each other. And then their little, side tentacles connect to each other like wires along a chain. And so these wires along a chain need to be connected. If the rats got Campylobacter but did not get SIBO, the chain is there, but it's a little bit less impressive. In the rats that got SIBO, the chain is broken. You can see one cell here, but you really can't. Maybe there's one there, it's hard to know, but the cells are diminished. And you can see that the number of cells, when you count them blindly, so we didn't know which group was which, and you count them, the number of cells is lower in the group that got Campylobacter and that was treated with SIBO. So this is what's happening. This is how it happens. So you have this nerve damage, and then you get bacterial overgrowth. Well, we actually showed this all the way back in 2022. I know the stream of thought is to go from left to right in science, but sometimes you get scattershot and you have to start to put together the pieces. It's sort of like actually literally doing a puzzle where you're doing the face and the head because that's easier rather than the trees in the background, which is harder when you're putting pieces of a puzzle together. But we already knew back in 2002 that if you have IBS and SIBO, the number of your cleaning waves of the gut, which those little cells I showed you on the last slide are controlling, are down, a lot down. Not only that, 50%, half of IBS patients with SIBO, we didn't detect any cleaning waves at all. So a bunch of zeros down here that are averaged into this this final average. So the cleaning waves aren't working, and this is a known cause of SIBO all the way back in 1977. No cleaning waves, poor cleaning waves, you get bacterial overgrowth, and that's sort of how it happens. So let's get down to a little bit more nitty gritty on the CDTB toxin. And I know this is going to get into some really dense science, but you need to know how important CDTB is and is the root. Because when you know the root of a disease, then you can root it out and cure it. And so this is a very big focus of our research, especially in the coming years, future years. So we said, okay, so if CDTB, it's not Campylobacter, it's not Shigella, it's not Salmonella, it's the CDTB toxin that does all of this. If we just give the rats CDTB, that's it, nothing else. And we use it like a vaccine, like you would get the COVID vaccine. And in fact, it's almost identical. You take one dose, 3 weeks later, you take the second booster. That's how we gave COVID vaccine. We do the same in rats with the CDTB toxin. Well, sure enough, they didn't have antibodies to CDTB before. They were clean rats. They didn't see Campylobacter. After the CDTB immunization, of course, the antibodies go way up. But look what happens to vinculin antibodies. Vinculin, we're not giving them vinculin. We're just giving them CDTB, but vinculin antibodies went up. So they were able to develop autoimmunity as a result of being exposed to CDTB. And only CDTB, that's all the rats saw. We didn't put it in the gut. We put it in their arm, under their skin, as a vaccine, they got SIBO. So CDTB antibodies create SIBO. And that is a really important finding. Not only that, they had reduced vinculin expression in their gut. So we were able to see that the CDTB antibodies are damaging the vinculin going on in the gut. So kind of works like this. You get food poisoning. This toxin goes into your body and you're reacting to it. So you form antibodies to this part, to this part, to this part, because all of it's foreign. You want to get rid of this toxin. But one of the antibodies is similar to the protein sequence in vinculin, and that's called mimicry. The CDTB is tricking you to form antibodies to yourself, and then you get a lot of these bad changes. Well, this was DDW last year. Now, this paper is in process of being published, so it'll be finally published, I don't know, a few weeks, we hope. But it is public information because it was presented at DDW. But it's very important we repeated that experiment with CDTB. And again, no antibodies before that toxin, a whole bunch of antibodies after the toxin. The wet weight of the stool went up because of the toxin and the antibodies. And the higher the antibody was, the higher the stool wet weight was. So the antibodies are driving the phenotype or the presentation of diarrhea in these animals in this second, more detailed study. In this second detailed study, we were able to do microbiome sequencing, and we show that nothing's happening in the colon. So the CDTB toxin, the antibodies, they're not changing your microbiome of your colon. They're changing the microbiome of the duodenum and ileum, meaning the small intestine. And how it does this is a little complicated, so I will walk you through this. The rats who got no toxin, they're orange. That's normal microbiome of the small bowel. The green rats are rats who got toxin, but their microbiome's fine. It's the same, didn't change. So remember at the beginning, I said, you get Campylobacter, and about 1 in 9 humans develop IBS. Well, the orange is the 1 in 9 humans. No, it's a little different with rats because we're giving a really big load of toxin. It's not like food poisoning. It's a little more industrial strength study. So it may not be 1 in 9, it may be 1 in 3 for rats. But the point is that you get the toxin. Some people, they don't get IBS. They just don't get it. And that's what we're trying to emphasize. But then the blue and the purple do get IBS. But the rats are going in two different directions. There's a group of rats going into a direction of, oh, my overgrowth is going to be E. coli, which is a hydrogen producer, and I have diarrhea. My overgrowth is going to go in the direction of desulfovibrio, which is a hydrogen sulfide producer, and I have even more diarrhea. Because that was their microbiome was set up to go in two bad directions, and they either go in one or the other, and that's what we saw on this. I want you to remember that, because we now call these microtypes. So the IBS patient or the SIBO patient can, with diarrhea, forget about constipation for a second, with diarrhea can end up with one of two microtypes, hydrogen or hydrogen sulfide. And that's what we see in rats when we give this toxin. And that's exactly what we see in humans with SIBO, two different microtypes for the diarrhea side. And I'll show you that later. But it's really important to understand that we're getting exactly the same results in rats as we're getting in humans, which is really important and remarkable that we can duplicate like that. This is a paper that a poster we presented at DDW. So it's an extension of this study, same study. But now we take the rat small bowel and we say, what's going on? What are these microtypes doing to you, the rat, at the tissue level? What are you doing to defend yourself? What are you doing that's causing the illness to be manifest? And what we show is all microtypes shared differences in gene expression, but circadian rhythm is affected, barrier function is affected, motility is affected, and visceral hypersensitivity is affected. A lot of words. But basically what's happening is your gut becomes leaky. That's the gut barrier impairment that's happening. The motility of the gut is affected, which we already showed you that the motility is affected, and that's why the overgrowth occurs. And visceral sensitivity, meaning the chemicals that make your nerves feel pain more easily, are up. So it's sort of like you have a cut in your skin and there's bacteria there. You feel pain there because of that infection or that bacteria. Same thing's happening in the gut. So if you get a little bit of gas in there, you're going to feel pain more than somebody who has the same amount of gas. So all of these things are not surprising, but it's surprising it all comes into this model that we're seeing exactly everything we see in IBS, we're seeing manifested by this CDTB toxin, which is brand new and very, very exciting, putting this all together. So can markers of CDTB and vinculin predict IBS? So in other words, could you diagnose IBS by measuring these antibodies? And the answer is yes. I'll show you the results. So here's the anti-CDTB toxin, or anti-CDTB toxin antibody blood test. So this is the second generation test. I'll show you the difference in a minute. The second generation test was done because the first generation test was okay, but there's a problem with the way the antibody binds to the protein, and we figured out the way to make the protein more exposed in a specific way called epitope optimization so that the antibodies could get to it more easily. And so, and when we did that, it's better test. It's a much better test for anti-vinculin and for anti-CDTD. And so I'm going to walk you through this so you understand this. If you just had a positive anti-CDTB or anti-vinculin, your post-test probability of having IBS, meaning you have a positive test, what's the chance you now have IBS, is 89 and 88%. If both markers are positive, 98% chance you have IBS. In terms of diagnostic testing, medical certainty is 80% or above. So you want to be above 80% because that's considered by diagnostic tests medical certainty. When you develop diagnostic tests, the most important number is likelihood ratio. We're going to get really deep in the weeds, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to explain this to you. The likelihood ratio is what determines your post-test probability. The higher this number is, the better the post-test probability. So we did develop the first assay, the first one, and this was the number for CDTB, 5.2. It's now 6.3. It was 2.0. It's now 5.3 here. So much, much better. How does that work, or how does that compare to what's out there? So let's do a post-test probability. The gray bar is medical certainty, and anything below 80% is suboptimal, but can be used, but is suboptimal if you don't have something better. So pain perception is just a way of looking at whether patients have an accelerated or an accentuated response to pain. That's useless because the pretest probability is 55%, so that doesn't do anything. There used to be a 34 biomarker panel, which was an algorithmic sort of AI determined panel. Didn't really get there. Bile acids in the stool doesn't get there. There was a 10 biomarker panel that was on the market temporarily. Still, it's not there anymore, 79%. Visceral hyperalgesia, you put a balloon in the rectum and you feel pain at an easier threshold, meaning a lower amount of volume. It gets there, but it's not great. Volatiles in the stool, pretty good, hard to get this test. The first generation test of CDTB and vinculin, which is still on the market as another test, which I'm not going to mention, but this is where it sits. Anti-vinculin here at 60, CDTB at 80. The second generation test, the anti-vinculin is 87%, 89% for CDTB, and if both are positive, it's 98%. So you can see this is a huge improvement, and is the second generation test really is now the gold standard, or at least the best test that we know of currently for the diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea to diagnose, especially post-infectious IBS. So, and so here's how it works. I'm going to summarize this first half. You've got all these beautiful bacteria in your gut, all sorts of colors and shapes and sizes, and they're just wonderful. They're supposed to be there. Then you get Campylobacter, these green things with a flagella on the back, and they invade. They produce CDTB toxin, which you get exposed to. You start forming antibodies to CDTB first. The antivinculin comes later. But when the antivinculin comes, you start to get a breakdown of the nerves, those special little cells I showed you that are reaching out towards each other. They're not anymore. You get a diminished cleaning wave, and then you get a whole bunch of these characters. And I'm going to talk about these characters when we talk about breath testing next, and that's SIBO. So now let's go to breath testing, because we need to look at breath testing and what is the evidence for what breath test you should use, how you should use it, and so forth. So ironically, at DDW, there was somebody who was a very particular expert in meta-analysis, did not show this meta-analysis, which is the gold standard meta-analysis, the most recent meta-analysis on breath testing in IBS. And it's clear that anything above one is significant. This is the summation of all breath test studies for IBS, and you can see that it's way up there. So breath testing is abnormal in IBS more than it is in healthy controls. People say to me, well, what percentage of IBS should be positive on a breath test? Well, if you just run the numbers on every trial that's done, it's about 49%. So if you're getting 80% positivity on breath testing, there's something wrong, because it shouldn't be that high. It should be, I would argue, between 50 and 60% of IBS is positive if you use lactulose, in my experience, and you have an experienced clinician. Remember, 60% of IBS is this pattern of things that I've been talking to you about today. But breath testing is more complicated than we knew. If you, those of you who are old like me, hydrogen was the original gas on breath testing. There was no methane on the breath test, there was only hydrogen. That to me is a useless breath test, because you can't just measure hydrogen. Hydrogen is the fuel for the two other gases, hydrogen sulfide and methane. So if you don't know the hydrogen sulfide or the methane, you don't know how much hydrogen is being eaten up by other organisms. We now know hydrogen sulfide is associated with diarrhea more, and methane is associated with constipation more. So you need to know, in my view, all three gases, and I'm going to provide you evidence for that. Let's go to the culture studies, because culture was considered the gold standard. So the argument against breath testing was, okay, breath testing, great, but it doesn't tell us what's really going on in the gut. I'm going to argue that's not true today because of some of the new slides I have. But at the time, in 2007, culture is the gold standard. Look at culture. Culture is more abnormal in IBS than healthy. So yes, there's more SIBO. If you use the correct cutoff, which we now prove is correct, I'll show you that data in a moment too, 10 to the 3, meaning 1,000 bacteria in the gut or higher is considered SIBO in the small bowel, 60% of IBSD is SIBO. So that's, again, the 60% rule of IBSD, 60% we think have SIBO. So that brings us to the Reimagine study, which we're doing at CEDARS, which is a very large scale effort to try to determine whether the small bowel microbiome is important to many, many different diseases. And we just had a paper on scleroderma come out. So if you look at other things we're doing, you will see papers on obesity, you will see papers on a lot of different topics, and because we're finding things. But let's stay focused on small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. I've shown this before. Each ring is getting deeper and deeper into the depths of what bacteria it actually is. So if you start in the middle, you can see this is bacteria, the bacterial kingdom. And then when you go to the next ring, it's the phylum. So there's proteobacteria here, firmicutes here, if you're familiar with these terminologies. And then the further out you go, you get down to the genus, and the outer ring is the species. You can see we are not naming the species because we don't know with 16S. So early sequencing data uses 16S sequencing. 16S sequencing can only get so far to understand the microbiome. But even with this paper in 2020 using 16S, Klebsiella, and this gray one is Escherichia, which is E. coli. These are not pathogens. These are not bacteria that you eat in a bad restaurant and you get food poisoning. These are bugs that are in your gut, but they shouldn't be this many. They shouldn't be this high in your gut. Look at the normal person. If you go to proteobacteria, look how small proteo is, proteo being here, and then you go down to Klebsiella is this little tiny layer here, and Escherichia is this one here. Look how huge it is in bacterial overgrowth, and I'll show you more details, a lot more interesting than that. One of the interesting things of that paper, though, is that when we used lactulose breath testing, we were able to get a great correlation. It was the most, if you use the 20 part per million at 90 minutes, you had the best sensitivity and specificity against culture, against the sequencing results, and that the hydrogen was coming from activation of hydrogen production pathways in the small bowel. So when you're giving lactulose and you're getting a positive breath test, it's from the hydrogen producers that are in the small bowel, not the colon. So those who argue that lactulose is checking for colon bacteria, it's not true. This study disproves that, or proves that the hydrogen is elevated in the small bowel. Now I'm gonna talk a little bit about intestinal methanogen overgrowth, and then I'm gonna start to put this into a really deep concept to get you to understand how much more we know. But we know that Methanobrevibacter smithii, that methane producer, is the culprit in producing methane in the gut. And when it produces it at a high amount, because there's a lot more of these guys in the gut, you get constipated, you get bloated. We've even shown a lower heart rate and a lot of other properties of methane that are good, but not good in high amounts. A little bit on the sulfate reducing bacteria, or hydrogen sulfide producers. So they take hydrogen from other bugs like E. coli, and they convert it to hydrogen sulfide. But it is the hydrogen sulfide that drives the amount of diarrhea you have, urgency and pain, and then other factors can come into overproduction of these characters. So we had to work on developing a gas breath test that actually measures all three. And this took years, because this is not an easy challenge for two reasons, or a lot of reasons. Here's the list. You're not able to transport hydrogen sulfide, hydrogen, and methane across the country with existing technologies a number of years ago, especially hydrogen sulfide, because it's so reactive. So it needs a special bag, a special system for transportation. You need to develop an instrument that can measure all three, and in such a way that you're not cross-reading other gases inappropriately. So you don't want somebody with high hydrogen to show up on the hydrogen sulfide sensor because it cross-reacts with that gas. So you have to orient the sensors in the instrument in a way that that doesn't happen, and then you get an accurate result. And then you have to do science to prove that the test actually works, and that hydrogen sulfide is valuable, and that the you know, what cutoff should we use. And so initially started at 5 parts per million. It moved to 3 parts per million, but I'm going to argue that it really should be 2 parts per million. And you're going to say, why does he keep changing the cutoff for hydrogen sulfide? Well, what you would hate is for me to say, oh, just use 2 because I think that's right. And then later I say, no, it was never 2, it was 3. And then a whole bunch of people are getting medications for a presumed hydrogen sulfide positive when it really wasn't true. You have to wait for the science to adjust your criteria. You can't make stuff up. And I try very hard not to make things up as we go. Sometimes it takes patience from us and from, you know, the viewers, to wait for the science to tell us what the right thing is to do. So I know sometimes that frustrates people, but you can't just say stuff. You have to have some backing in science. So this was the original study where we used the 5 part per million cutoff. These were diarrhea patients, what we call functional diarrhea, not DIBS or IBSD. These were functional patients, and you can see that hydrogen sulfide was way up here as compared to the healthy and the constipation patients. And that hydrogen sulfide was proportional to the amount of diarrhea. But I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I have a lot better data now. So this is a study where it's a double-blind randomized controlled trial for a drug that we're working on for diarrhea IBS, which you can't talk about, and constipation IBS, a different trial, a double-blind randomized controlled trial. In both studies, at the baseline, we did lactulose breath testing with 3 gases. So this is really important because this study for the first time is showing that a breath test using 3 gases and specifically having to use lactulose, we correlate with the gut bacteria at a microscopic level. So the breath test is in fact telling us very clearly what's going on in terms of the proportion of bacteria in the gut that are causing problems. So this is a really important because it emphasizes lactulose as an important substrate, and it emphasizes that the 3-gas breath test is the only breath test that is validated against the microbiome in this detail. So let's go and get cut into it. So if you look at methane and you're a IBSD patient, you're the blue line here. You don't have methane. The D patients almost never have methane. It's and we didn't select patients for SIBO. This was an IBSD, IBSC trial. Here you can see that not everybody with C had methane, but the ones that did, this was the methane level. So it was quite high. And it starts high. We always knew that with methane. Methane's either there or not there. It doesn't get necessarily all that much higher with the lactulose. Hydrogen, on the other hand, is the blue line here again. IBSD, look at the hydrogen. On average in a D patient, by 90 minutes, it's over 20. Now, of course, there might be some below there. Remember we said 60%, but on average, the majority of the patients already reached the threshold that they really truly have SIBO. Look at the methane people. The methane needs hydrogen to make methane. It has to have hydrogen to make methane. And look at the hydrogen values in the methane group. Lower than even the non-methane constipated patients. Why am I saying that? Because when you're measuring methane, your hydrogen is lower because the hydrogen's being eaten to make methane. So you can't measure hydrogen without knowing methane. And I will argue that you can't measure hydrogen without knowing hydrogen sulfide. Also, same problem. Here's the hydrogen sulfide levels are higher in IBSD versus the other two groups. Here's where we're now getting really exciting. So the new 3-gas breath test using lactulose as the substrate, we can correlate directly with the amount of M. smithii in the gut. And you can see these are the correlations, these are the p-values. So the breath test is validated by the fact that, yeah, we're actually measuring methane on the breath. Yeah, we're actually measuring correlating with the amount of methanogens in the gut, and yeah, we are correlating with constipation. So it validates the breath test more. And these are the correlations. We're able to correlate the methane, here's the methane, correlating with methanogens, 2 types of methanogens in the gut. Again, proving this correlation. I'm not going to get into too much details, except I'm going to say one thing about this. These two characters, Christensenyl ACA and Ruminococcus ACA, are the gut bugs that produce the hydrogen for the patients with methane. It's not the E. coli and Klebsiella. This is the constipation side of the story that's really unfolding very quickly now. But I'm not going to get into all those details. In the hydrogen sulfide group, the hydrogen sulfide on the breath test correlates with the hydrogen sulfide producing organisms in the gut. Again, validating that what we're seeing on the breath test, let me just emphasize it very clearly. The lactulose is driving hydrogen sulfide production. The hydrogen sulfide we're seeing on the breath test is being measured accurately to the point where we're able to correlate with actual microbes in the gut. So the bags get sent 5 days, whatever it takes to get to the lab, and still the gases correlate perfectly, or very well, I should say, statistically, with the microbiome. Never been shown for a breath test. So this is a really important study that was published just before New Year's. And that the breath test is correlating, the hydrogen sulfide level is correlating with Fusobacterium, which is a hydrogen sulfide producer. Okay, I'm gonna skip this because it's now getting too deep and I'm gonna lose you all, but again, the breath test, using the three gas breath test, methane correlates with all the stuff that makes methane. And on the right, the hydrogen sulfide correlates with all the stuff that makes hydrogen sulfide in the gut, all the way to the pathway level. So we now, with this three gas breath test, can see and correlate with the gut bacteria three distinct microtypes. And so this is all new. Hydrogen microtype, the sulfur or hydrogen sulfide microtype, and then the methanogen or methane microtype, which drives constipation. So constipation here, diarrhea for these two groups. So let's talk about breath testing now as we wrap up, getting closer to the end. I do have a few more tidbits for you. So I know this is a long presentation, but bear with me. These are the three consensus. We did the first consensus on breath testing 2018. Here are the follow-ons. There's most of the world who's had consent, part of these consensus statements agree with the criteria for SIBO. Most of the world agrees with the substrates and dosing. And most of the world agrees that SIBO and IBS are interrelated now. So we've come a long way from 1996. But here's the newest stuff. So now we're trying to get to the point where we're able to say, okay, now we know who exactly is causing all this hydrogen. We know it's Escherichia, we know it's Klebsiella, but we need to know more. We need to know exactly who they are. And this is culturing the small bowel. So some centers in the United States culture the small bowel, and they take this agar and they pull it together and they say, hey, if it's over this, you got overgrowth. This agar does not work. Look how many patients we have in this study. It's a huge number of patients. It doesn't work. It does not. There's no difference in diversity of the microbiome using the blood agar. But look what happens when you use McConkie agar and you get to greater than 10 to the 3. Already you're seeing a tipping point in the microbiome. So anything over 1,000 on this growth media or agar is overgrowth. This is super interesting. This was just presented a few days ago. This is your network of your microbiome. The network is all these lines connecting dots, are all the microbes in your gut all communicating with each other in the sense that, hey, if I'm here, you should be here, and we're like a family. We got a plumber here, we got a doctor here, we got a lawyer here, we've got a sanitation worker, et cetera, et cetera. The city is in harmony because there's lots of dots and lots of lines. That's a good, healthy microbiome. But the microbiome starts to break apart when you get to over that 1,000 mark on that growth media. And when you get to over 100,000 of those bad bacteria, it breaks down completely. Nothing's connected. There's only a few dots, a few lines, and the microbiome really starts to just fall apart. We also presented at DDW the methanogens, and they are everywhere. So the point is, the biggest group is still the Methanobrevibacteriaceae, which is Methanobrevibacter smithii, which I've told you about. And they are in the duodenum and they are in the stool. So they are, that's why it's called EMO, intestinal methanogen overgrowth, because it's not just in the small bowel, it's in the stool also at almost equal amounts. And then I want to show you something really sort of interesting, and then one more thing interesting after that, because I think this, it's just getting so deep. This is an app that we use to look at stool. So patients take a picture of their stool before, you know, wiping and putting paper in the toilet. And we're able to see exactly what the stool looked like, and the AI in the app calculates this Bristol score, the edge fuzziness, fragmentation, and other factors. And when you have methane, your Bristol stool score is lower, your edge fuzziness is less, meaning the stool is more smooth and tight, like balls and fragments, and you have less fragmentation, meaning you don't have like little bits and bits and bits and bits of loose stool. Look what happens with hydrogen sulfide, and this is really important. So if your hydrogen sulfide is positive, you have more stool volume. Compared to a hydrogen positive patient, when your hydrogen sulfide is there, you have more stool volume. If you're negative for all three gases, the difference is even greater. If your hydrogen sulfide is greater than 2, that's when the volume starts going up. So 2 may be a better cutoff, and that's where we're heading and continuing to learn more science around hydrogen sulfide. All right, and finally, remember I showed you this circle and I showed you that SIBO is really important. Now with shotgun sequencing, we can figure it out all the way down to the strain level, what bacteria are present. So similar circle, except now we got the outer ring, which is here, okay? So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna continue this and show you, this is SIBO. This is what normal people have for this group of bacteria called proteobacteria. This is normal here on this side, tiny amount, tiny piece of the pie. More than 50% of your entire microbiome is now proteobacteria. But no, it's more than that. Look at this. 18% of your entire microbiome is one species, Klebsiella pneumoniae, and another 28% is just E. coli, which is this one here, this gray one here. And now we know all the strains of these organisms that are part of SIBO and all the bad things that they can do. And so when we know the strains and the species, we can direct our treatments even more better. And these species and strains that we identified for SIBO are correlating with bloating, gas, abdominal pain, diarrhea, urgency, etc. for both sides, both Klebsiella and E. coli. And they are together in most cases. So we now know the exact strains of bacteria that cause SIBO. But can you imagine your beautiful microbiome of 500 different bacteria boiled down to 2 species taking up almost 50%, almost half of everything there, and that's SIBO. Nothing in the reimagined study looks like this. This is very, very remarkable apocalypse of your microbiome. And then the last thing I'm going to show you is this because this really kind of emphasizes the point. So because you have these E. coli and Klebsiella pneumoniae in your small bowel, what happens is these two characters are amazing fermenters. So they jack up your ability to digest sugars to new highs. So people say, well, I just ate and then I'm already getting gassy. The small bowel is so jacked up to ferment because of the high numbers of these very intense fermenters that you get these upregulations, like 63 times higher amounts of glucose degradation. Don't be fooled by that. That doesn't mean a glucose breath test is better. I'm saying carbohydrate digestion is all accentuated. Hydrogen sulfide production is accentuated. And then there's some of these other pathways, which I won't get into today because it really is going to be too complicated, but super interesting pathways that you will hear more from me about in the coming year or two. Again, I'm showing you these networks. This is what happens with E. coli. When it goes to this level, it's more broken. When it goes to this level, higher level, it's even more broken. Klebsiella is even more destructive. You can see that the network really sort of just starts to fall apart as Klebsiella goes up. And then finally, these are the pathways in humans. Again, strong association with motility genes, with barrier function. So these bugs and the CDTB toxin and everything on top of each other are changing your barrier function, changing your histamine secretion, changing your inflammatory response, changing your motility, and causing further worsening of the situation. So three gases is what we measure: hydrogen, hydrogen sulfide, and methane. This is the physiologic sequence, which we've built greater evidence on at all levels since the last time I've spoken to you. We treat IBS based on this study. Rifaximin is FDA approved for irritable bowel syndrome, but if your breath test is positive, you're more likely to respond to rifaximin, 56 versus 44. And if you make that abnormal breath test normal, those patients respond 76% of the time. In methane, we give rifaximin and neomycin based on this double-blind study. That's what we do. It's not FDA approved like that, but if you're methane, this study is something to lean on for treating methane positive. We don't have a new thing for hydrogen sulfide out yet, but things are coming. Let's say that. So this is what I do in my clinic based on everything I've told you. You've got chronic diarrhea, mixed. I do the antibody measurements because it helps the patient. It helps me understand what's going on. I do the three gas breath test. If it's hydrogen, I give rifaximin. If it's hydrogen sulfide, now greater than two for me in my clinic, I give bismuth and rifaximin. And that's worked really well for some patients. And ironically, some of the patients with hydrogen sulfide, a year later, they don't relapse like the ones with hydrogen. Constipation, I don't need to measure these antibodies because that's not part of the mechanism there, but I do the three gas breath test because there are patients who have all three gases. I've seen this often enough. Methane always wins. So you will be constipated if you have methane. But what you don't want is to get the methane down, not treat the hydrogen sulfide, and then flip them to diarrhea. So I still want to know all three gases. And I use rifaximin and neomycin, or sub the neomycin with metronidazole, which seems in clinical practice to be working just as well. So three more slides. I started with this slide that this is where we were with IBS in 1996. This is where we are now with the microbiome. I've shown you a lot of this detail. I'm not going to go through this slide, but a lot has happened. And so in conclusion, IBS is commonly a small bowel microbiome disease. SIBO is very important contributor to that. We now know the characters, E. coli, Klebsiella pneumoniae, and that they produce the hydrogen, and getting rid of that hydrogen, getting rid of those bacteria makes you better, makes the patient better. M. smithii, or methanogens, are responsible for the methane in the gut, and they constipate. Getting rid of methane makes the constipation better. Hydrogen sulfide is really important to further understand that this third dimension of the microbiome. The breath test, the three gas breath test, is now validated. The whole system is validated against sequencing of the gut. So what you see on the breath test is what we're seeing in the gut and the microbiome. So that's super important. And everything we've done uses lactulose. So the lactulose and the system of three gases is what's being validated here. And this second generation antibody test is far better than the first generation and is more accurate and important. So we're understanding IBS for the first time in new ways, and I think it's going to change how we treat this disease. So I'm going to stop there, and hopefully it wasn't too long.
Keep going as far as we're concerned. Trust
us. Oh my God, not too long at all. I'm like, skip over that slide. Talk more. It's fabulous.
That's amazing. Congratulations on all the progress, seriously.
Yeah, a lot of progress this year. So I'm really, really excited for patients.
Yeah. Thank you so much for all your work that you do every year on behalf of all of us. This is incredible. Incredible.
It really is. And your advocacy by actually going and doing podcasts and being with us for our sessions and stuff, like, we really appreciate it. And we're thrilled to get the word out to people because this is exciting. You know, we're not used to having a condition that we get to watch the research emerge and know that there's so much hope coming, like within our lifetime, within years. So it's very motivational for us to stay the course. And of course, we want to let you know you're very appreciated. So send our best to the team. We have questions.
I'm here,
Allison,
for questions.
I'll let you start.
Okay, I'd love to start with something slightly off topic from the research that's new that you presented, because so many people are thinking about this now. In the last year, there's been a huge publication or awareness raising an increase of use of semaglutide and similar drugs. So this is sold as Ozempic, Wegovy, Rybelsus. And we know that one of the mechanisms of actions of this drug is to slow stomach emptying, slow upper GI motility. And so I have two questions. First off is, should people be concerned that this could be a cause of SIBO by slowing the migrating motor complex?
Well, all these drugs, including Mounjaro, this is the other one, are commonly used now, and it actually affects a lot of what we do. For example, if you're on one of these medications and you do a breath test, it's a flat line, because galactulose never leaves the stomach. The stomach just doesn't empty. So it's not that it slows the cleaning waves, it slows everything. So it's more problematic than that. Now, we don't have a lot of details on if you're on one of these medications, are you getting more SIBO or not, or are you going to precipitate SIBO? We don't know. I mean, it's really early days on this, but one would imagine anything that slows the gut down leads to bacterial buildup. There's no doubt about that in my mind. So what that does in the long run, we don't quite know yet, but you're right, it's a big problem. Well, I guess obesity is a big problem, and solving obesity and these medications actually working is actually a good thing. But there's always a yin and a yang with everything we do in medicine. So you can solve one problem only leading to another. You know, and another example of that is these, and I'm blanking on the name of the category of drugs, but these new anti-cancer drugs, amazing. They're amazing, but they cause type 1 diabetes in some patients because they destroy your islet cells. So we're seeing a resurgence of diabetes in a lot of patients from these anti-cancer drugs, which are life-saving. So, you know, it's, you're beating away one devil and you're getting another devil, and you got to decide which devil's worse. Cancer is obviously a bad example because it kills you, and diabetes can be managed. So you take those risks, but you know, this is what we do in medicine. We have to put everything on a balance.
Well, my second question on that is, what about for people who already have SIBO, who want to take this or start taking it? Have you seen any examples or any concerns there that it's going to make their symptoms worse because it's going to slow motility more?
Yeah, I have a few patients, but very, very few, because I think they know that slowing the gut down causes them to be more bloated. But it's always more complicated than you think, because what those drugs force you to do is eat less. You eat less, you ferment less. You have less substrate for the bacteria. So maybe on balance, it doesn't do much. It doesn't make it worse. It doesn't make it better. It keeps it about the same. I don't know, but we need to study it, because it's going to be, almost everybody's going to be on these medications, judging from what I'm seeing in the news media, because even people who are not so obese want to lose a few pounds. They're on these medications now too.
Thank you. And Siobhan, did you want to say anything more about that?
I have personal experience with it because I have been on semaglutide because of my blood sugar. And I'm half Indian from India, which I know you're familiar with, Dr. Pimentel. And, you know, and my father died of a heart attack and definitely had insulin issues. And I, you know, so, you know, skinny arms and legs and a tummy, right? So that's very typical for Southeast Asians. And I've never puked so much in my life because the stomach doesn't empty. And so has it made my SIBO worse if I was, you know, feeling positive at the time? It hasn't, but like you're saying, there are other implications to it. So jury's still out, but you know, it's been interesting.
Coming back up, it's not feeding the bacteria. So, you know.
Well, there you go. There's a positive.
That's not a positive, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, this is the problem. You're going to be eating less because of these drugs. And so maybe they get less food, and therefore it doesn't, on balance, it doesn't change anything. But I'm just speculating. We don't have any data yet.
Yeah. I'll keep you posted if I come up with anything interesting and substantial. Allison, what other questions do you have?
Okay, thanks so much, Dr. Pimentel. That's it's been on my mind much since everyone's been exploding with that drug. I mean, you know. Yeah. Okay, this is interesting. I just wanted to know, I was so taken with your explanation of the likelihood ratio for your second generation CDTB test. And what I was thinking about was the fact that other than your first generation test, there are, I think, two other versions of that test on the market, you know, copycat labs. And there are a lot of functional medicine practitioners and naturopaths who use those other labs because they order stool tests or something else from those labs, who knows? And so then they just are using those labs for their CDTB testing. Do we know anything about the likelihood ratios and the validation of those other laboratories?
Well, here's what I can tell you. None of them are using epitope optimization because they don't even know what that means. It's an internal process that occurs with the second generation test. So basically, they're all first generation technologies. So you can see what you get is what you get, and it's not that great. It's great, but it's not that great. It's not as good as the second generation. So it doesn't make sense. I mean, if I was a patient and I'm paying the same price for two tests, you get the one that works better, I guess, is how I see it. And the more accurate it is, the better it is, the less, the more you're likely to do the right thing for the patient and save money, which is, you know, what I said at the beginning. So the more accurate your test, the more money you save in healthcare, period. Everybody knows this. So we tried to improve it to get it more accurate because we knew it wasn't good enough. I think it's good enough now. Because we can't really improve on it.
Okay, great. Thanks. Just clarifying, it sounds like you're using 2 parts per million now for your criteria for positive for hydrogen sulfide. Will we see a change coming officially in the
So I think test? I think based on the newest data, they're going to adjust the report to say, you know, based on new evidence, there is accumulating evidence that 2 might be the cutoff. So use it in your judgment in your clinical practice. So in my clinical practice, 2 will be the new cutoff for me. That's what I'll be treating. So because I think I feel confident enough. But you know, we're not done. We're still studying this. There's more to be done to define it better, to define new treatments. You know, we're always about 2 years ahead of slides I show here. So we know a lot more things about what's coming. So there's exciting things coming. So I'm very optimistic.
I know. And Siobhan always tries to get it out of you and you never crack.
That's why I said it now. So I can avoid that.
I know. You beat me to it.
Okay. Another one is, so exciting about figuring out the species and strains for the Klebsiella now. You know, also, I just want to say how incredible this is. You know, I love the way you started the presentation with, you know, bringing us back to how it was and how still we're having troubles with the acceptance here and the comparison to Crohn's, you know, with IBS and SIBO. And it's really getting harder and harder for people to maintain that when you're getting down to the species and strain level of exactly which bacteria are causing the problem. So that's amazing. But I was wondering, you were talking in one of the abstracts about how you have a unspecified strain of Enterobacter, I think. Is that right? And I was has been found as one of the culprits. That's new, isn't it? Like,
are you talking about that table at the bottom?
It was in one of your abstracts.
Oh, I see what you're saying. An unspecified strain of Enterobacter. Yeah, in one of the abstracts.
Yeah, one of the abstracts is like there's E. coli, there's the two strains or species of Klebsiella, and then an unidentified Enterobacter. Is Entero, because I'm not very good with all the genus species strains, and is in the previous work you had done, you had said you would found a little bit of Aeromonas. Mm-hmm. And now you're saying Enterobacter. I was wondering, like, is Aeromonas underneath the heading of Enterobacter, or are these just two different things you found?
So remember 16S, I don't know if you're familiar with the two technologies, but 16S is measures ribosomal RNA sequences. And so it, the ribosomal RNA of different bacteria have different sequences. When we do that, there's a lot of overlap between different bacteria, a lot. And so when the computer goes through the algorithm and says, okay, who does this line up with? Who does this line up with? Who does this sequence line up with? They make estimates. And then there's confidence estimates as well. And so when we say with 16S that it is Aeromonas or Enterobacter or Escherichia, it's an estimate. Shotgun sequencing, we're sequencing the DNA from the central core of the bacteria. And if you sequence long enough and enough of it, you know exactly who that organism is with 99% estimation. And so what we could have called Aeromonas before with a rough estimate, we now call Escherichia or something else. We don't know how it'll, we'd have to go back and compare the sequences and why it said Aeromonas and now it doesn't. We haven't done that exercise, but it's not so important anymore because who cares? We now know the truth. The truth is shotgun. And so let's move forward with the truth. Forget about Aeromonas for now. That's how I see it, because we're just wasting time. We need to get to treatments now. We have the good answers, not the old answers.
Oh, that's very helpful.
It was always Escherichia and Klebsiella. We knew that even back then. We just didn't know the details down to the species and strain. And that continues to hold true.
Okay, very, very helpful. I also noticed in, I can't remember if it was the presentation or one of your abstracts, I think it was one of the abstracts, it looked like there were the one on methanogens, or at least one of the ones on methanogens, it looked like there was different syntrophs for methanogens between the duodenum and the stool. Yeah. Was that so?
There are
different. What's a syntroph, you guys? What's a syntroph?
Okay. Syntroph is like your buddy. And so you need a buddy to produce hydrogen to give you the hydrogen to make the methane. And we're in early days of understanding that, Allison. So I don't want to hang my hat on the syntroph thing yet, but it looks like in the colon, the Christensen-Lacea and Ruminococcus ACA holds true. In the small bowel, it may be other syntrophs. Because Christensenella, this is the thing we were confused about. Christensenella and Ruminococcus ACA are not common in the small bowel. And then the other thing you may have noticed is that Methanomyssilococcus ACA is the official name. That bug is a methanogen and it fights with the Methanobrevibacter. So the higher the Methanobrevibacter, the lower the Methanomyssilococcus. The higher the Methanomyssilococcus, the lower the Methanobrevibacter. And so they're like, you know, two competing gangs trying to win the methane day. But for the most part, it's M. smithii, I would say 80, 90% of the time. But the other ones are trying to muscle in. So a lot of interesting, it's like Game of Thrones, right? So we have these different families competing and are yelling at each other to try and win dominance in the gut. So.
Okay, great. Okay, and then amazing information about the genes that are affected in SIBO. You know, you presented on that today. And I just was hoping you could maybe clarify a little bit because, I mean, you were talking about these genes, leaky gut, histamine, circadian rhythm, all these things that seem to be an effect. These genes get altered from the SIBO. But there was also the motility piece. And you called that out a bit. We know that the motility gets slowed for SIBO to occur, but then it sounds like once the SIBO's there, motility is further affected. Could you clarify?
Yeah. So this is a part I can't clarify, not because I can't talk about it. It's not like that. It's because we haven't done the clarification yet. So we know that CDTB leads to antibodies that leads to slow motility. That does affect barrier function and all the things that CDTB poster I showed you. So a lot of the things we're seeing in the end game, the CDTB did. It affected barrier function, it affected motility, it affected visceral hypersensitivity. And then when we're seeing the final result, which is all this elevated E. coli and Klebsiella, we also see the same signals. So we're trying to figure out, okay, so all these signals are screwed up. But is it the E. coli and Klebsiella, or is it the CDTB that did it, that screwed it up? Yeah, which chicken or egg are related to all these findings? And that part is not exactly clear, you know, because with the CDTB, you're getting these elevations in E. coli and Klebsiella. So we're trying to dissect out, is it the SIBO that's causing some of these pathways? Is it the CDTB antibodies which are causing some of these pathways, or is it both? And what's causing what? So it's still a puzzle to be sorted out.
That's what I figured. This is the semester I teach at the college where I teach, and I shared the new research on genes with them the moment it came out on the, you know, last week. And that was their question, kind of like, chicken, egg, and I figured you were trying to figure it out still.
We are working on it, but it's a complicated question because it's impossible to separate the two. So what we would have to do is take the animals who are CDTB positive, treat their SIBO, get the E. coli, Klebsiella down, and see if these expression markers recover or if they're still screwed up. So that's a study we have not done, but that is the study that we need to do to prove that. So hard study to do in humans because it's a lot of aspirates and biopsies, and it's just too expensive and cumbersome for patients to go through.
I guess then I'll turn it over to Siobhan. I know you've got questions, but my last question is, were there any other abstracts or presentations at DDW this year that you were particularly excited about? Often you'll mention, oh, I want to call your attention to something else, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there. Well, I can tell you what was super exciting at DDW is for the first time in history, DDW had an entire session, multiple lectures on small bowel microbiome. And we've never had that at DDW. It's always been stool. So there's an entire section now dedicated to small intestinal microbiome, which is really, and people are working in the area finally. So, and that's the goal. This isn't about me, this is about patients. And I don't care who finds the final result that helps the patient. It's just, let's go, people, let's go. Let's get this done. Let's help some patients. So I'm super excited to see other people now interested in that. And they're saying things, and I'm listening to them talking, and they're saying things, and I'm like, oh, I can't believe somebody else said that. You know, like what they're saying, what the speaker who introduced the whole session said, well, we know we haven't found too much in the colon and stool, but in the small bowel, it's a large surface area, it's an absorbing surface, and so bacteria in the small bowel can affect the human more maybe than the colon. I'm like, I said that for a long time. I'm glad to see somebody else saying that. And so it's an exciting transition, let's put it that way.
That is very exciting.
That is very exciting. Good. Good. I'm glad just personally for you that you're getting that kind of like,
like the only one doing stuff. Otherwise, right. You know, part of medicine is, you know, you got to believe stuff, but validate it. Right? So it can't just be one center publishing an area. It's important that other people say, okay, I like the meta-analysis on breath testing. You know, Almost all those studies weren't us. One or two of them were, but the rest of them were other centers. Super important that everybody's getting the same result and the same signal and the same, you know, there were more studies on methane and constipation. So I think methane and constipation is a foregone conclusion. There are very few people who disagree with that now because other people have proven this to be true. So, you know, we keep moving forward and other people replicate it and or prove it's right or wrong. If they prove it's wrong, then we have to figure out what went wrong and correct it. But science, you take what falls out of science and you publish it, and then other people either verify it or we make adjustments over time.
Fantastic. All right, Allison, I have questions. Is it okay? I'm gonna take the mic. Okay. Dr. Pimentel, I want to just have you say it out loud for anyone who missed it before about what happens once SIBO emo is resolved to the microbiome, that it restores back to harmony, if you could.
We haven't published this, but we've seen it in the reimagined data set that patients who had SIBO who were treated, their microbiome completely comes back. It's like It's the weeds in the garden analogy. You pull all the weeds out and then the vegetables grow much better. And I think that's true. We don't see rifaximin resistance genes in the microbiome, which was amazing. We see this microbiome recovery after getting rid of the bullies. So I'm not sure rifaximin is, you know, people worry about antibiotics. Rifaximin's not quite like that. It does something special. At least that's what we're seeing. Look, we need to continue to monitor things and watch, but that's what I'm seeing so far.
So that is a really big message of hope for everyone who still has those questions about their microbiome. And I hope it's also motivating to everyone who's listening to this to like really go for it and get those treatments, because the rosacea can improve, right? The restless leg, all of these other associations. You were talking about with the low heart rate. I find that so interesting. Why? Do you know why there'd be a relationship between people with methane and lower heart rate?
Well, you know, so you know what we used to use to put people to sleep to do surgery? Carbon tetrachloride. You know what carbon tetrachloride is? A carbon with four chlorine molecules around it. We have a molecule called methane, which is a carbon with four hydrogens around it. So it's just a substituted hydrocarbon, carbon tetrachloride. Now, we don't use carbon tetrachloride anymore. We use isoflurane, which is still a substituted carbon molecule. And these gases, these anesthetic gases, affect you. They affect your blood pressure. They affect your pulse rate when you're under anesthesia. Methane has, I don't want to say anesthetic effects, but it has groggy effects because it's similar to all these anesthetic gases. It's like the canary in the coal mine. When the methane goes up, the canary falls asleep. So, and then you know there's too much methane in the coal mine. So that's maybe why patients get brain fog and with methane, and we just need to understand the methane effects more. But yeah, lower heart rate. Interesting. It's fascinating.
So it'd be easy to extrapolate that that could lead to fatigue, right? That kind of feeling of lethargy.
Well, if it blocks your heart rate or blocks the heart rate from going up appropriately or slows the response, so you can't exercise as vigorously because you can't get that response in heart rate. We're guessing here. We're just.
I know, right? Totally guessing.
Shooting the breeze because we don't have data yet. But there are a lot of potential implications of a lower heart rate and what that means. But when I say it's lower, we're talking about 3 beats per minute lower. So right. We're not talking about 20. We're talking about 3 beats per minute. But over a lifetime, that's a lot of beats, you know. And so, sure. That's all.
Okay, I'm gonna go to fungus land now. Through the grapevine, I heard that you guys did start talking a little bit about the fungal overgrowth. Yes, could you just elaborate on that a little bit?
I didn't put that slide in. It wasn't purposefully omitted. We had so much stuff, I didn't know how much to put in. But we actually, for the first time, sequenced fungus in the small bowel. And, you know, for whatever irony it is, if it's over 1,000 in the gut, it's associated with symptoms. And now it didn't happen often. So it's not like SIBO where it's common, it's uncommon. But when it is present, we said two things in the presentation. We said that it is, if it's over 1,000, you do get symptoms. If it's, and it's usually candida. And we're trying to isolate the specific species and strain and all the stuff that we've been doing with SIBO. And now we have the tools to do it, so it'll happen faster. We'll get that shortly. But we're on it. It's there. It's there, but not common.
That's exciting. Okay. And then I know there's been a lot of buzz. I've been following you on Twitter. I want everyone to do that. Is about the sweeteners.
Oh, I didn't put that here either.
Non-calorics. Yeah, it's okay. That's what Twitter's for. The non-caloric sweeteners and how they affect the microbiome.
Yeah, a lot of new stuff. So we've been saying in our low fermentation diet that aspartame is fine. It's a protein, so it's not a carbohydrate. and all the other ones are carbohydrates, and maybe that's bad for SIBO. And so we finally looked at that question in the Reimagine study. People who self-declare that they take aspartame, self-declare that they take these other sweeteners. And the other sweeteners, we saw over 70 different changes in the microbiome with the carbohydrate sweeteners. We didn't see things like that with aspartame. So yeah, the other sweeteners are doing substantial things to your microbiome. I can't say good or bad, but as you can see, when you have SIBO, you're, as I said, jacked up to ferment sugars. And if you put non-digestible sugars in there and you have that heightened ability to digest them, you're going to get more bloating. And so that's a bad thing. So it reinforces sort of what we've been saying, but with really good hard science.
I'm literally trying to find the name brand for the aspartame because I just have never used it.
It's NutraSweet. NutraSweet.
Okay. NutraSweet. Okay. Interesting. That's so interesting. Okay. And then when people do clear SIBO, back to us, a little bit more motivation for like taking the treatments on, what else do you see people's symptoms go away other than the bloating? They get regulation to their bowel movements. I know we talked with a couple of people, and Alice and I have talked about this a lot, that a lot of times food intolerances disappear. Fructose can then be, you know, consumed more comfortably. What else do you see as like, other than people like getting their lives back, but any other comments on that?
Well, I do see clearing of brain fog and other things as well. So there's a number of things that seem to get better. Allergy symptoms get better in some patients, not all patients, and not all patients have allergy symptoms. So it's just like the rosacea thing, where, you know, not everybody with SIBO has rosacea, but maybe that gets better in some of these individuals. So we see a lot of very interesting, odd things that happen, and they're not just one-offs. They're fairly routinely seen. So remember, these bacteria create an inflammatory condition. They really heighten your immune system. And so if you have immune disease, it's possible that it could flare it.
So just two more questions before we wrap. If someone had a positive CDTB from IBS Smart and they have methane on a SIBO breath test, would that indicate or give you a clue that it's actually, they have enough hydrogen to be feeding the methane? You talked about that a little bit. I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, so it's a little tricky, right? Because I don't routinely measure the antibodies in methane. So don't quote me on the numbers, even though I'm on recording here. So it's going to be, you know, set in stone. But if I remember correctly, the antibodies to CDTB and or vinculin are about here in healthies. They're here, the prevalence is here for IBSD, and for C it's here. So I'm not giving numbers. You see how I did that? That was good.
Yeah, that was good.
Wait, I can't remember the exact numbers. I remember the number is 56% for the CDTB and vinculin for IBSD, but I don't remember the other two. But there is a signal, a statistical signal for methane. But I just feel like if only one in four or five of methane people are positive, you got to spend money in five people to get one positive. I feel like that's not cost effective. So I tend to not do it. But
right. But
then again, brings up Allison's question, is these methanogens and their syntrophs are different if it's small bowel methane or it's colonic methane. And so if you get a bunch of Klebsiella and E. coli going up in the small bowel, giving fuel to the methanogens in the small bowel, maybe you can become methane positive in this scheme. But again, these are things we need to work out and figure out. And it's a complicated system to figure that out.
Okay. And as far as like the vaginal microbiome, do you feel like that could be impacting the small intestinal microbiome and the large intestinal microbiome due to like their proximity, or like the ability for microbiome bacteria just to like move around your body?
Generally speaking, the entry for the vaginal orifice and the anal canal are close in proximity. So you're more likely to see stool microbes sort of migrate into that area. rather than there be sort of this bugs going through the bloodstream or crossing the tissues and jumping into that area. So I think it's more that than the latter. So and when you have SIBO, it's possible there's more E. coli around, and E. coli is a common contaminant, for example, in urine infections, especially in women.
Right.
So is that where they're coming from? Hard to know.
I do have one comment also. Thank you for that. The first slide, which was talking about back in the 90s, where people were thinking that, it was a disease of hysterical women and all of that. And I saw on the left-hand side of the slide, stress, trauma, things like that. There's still a contingency of people who, and I understand why they're thinking that, who are like, well, I got really stressed and I got SIBO. You've talked about the military example in the past. Could you share that one more time for people who are just hearing it or as a reminder or for the first time?
Yeah, so my good colleague and friend, Mark Riddle, Dr. Mark Riddle, from, he used to be at the Research Institute for the US military in Bethesda and in Silver Spring, actually. And so he's no longer there, but what they found was that if you were in deployment, they looked at the factors in deployment, because these people were coming back from deployment in Iraq and Afghanistan. They were coming back with IBS. So what in deployment was the highest risk factor? Well, it turned out it wasn't stress. It wasn't whether you shot a gun, witnessed human death or suffering, or yourself was injured or maimed or had some kind of traumatic event. It was food poisoning, if you got food poisoning in combat. So it was the first example of looking at a person going through time, what they experienced, and why IBS developed. And it was food poisoning, and it wasn't all these stressful events. And I can tell you, in the US, in general, we're not going to experience the type of stress that somebody in combat military operations might experience. That's extreme. And so if that doesn't do it, how is it that my boss got mad at me today and I'm stressed going to do it? I'm not saying, we need to do more studies on stress and its effect on the gut. We know stress affects the gut. We know it changes the migrating motor complex. Does it make it worse? Yes. Is it the cause of IBS? I would argue that we have evidence that it's probably not the cause of IBS. It is a modifying factor.
Right. Okay, just thank you so much for saying that, because that gives a lot of clarity. Because people get in fights in the Facebook group are like, yes, it does, right? It's a contributing factor. Sure. And so,
think about it this way. Let's say your antibodies are putting it into the perspective of what I've shown you. Maybe your antibodies are borderline. And then you got stress as an additional factor, which is reducing your cleaning waves just that much more. And then you say, oh, it's the stress. But no, it's, you're at your tipping point, and then you tip it over with a little bit of stress, which makes the motility worse. So I can understand why people will actually feel and say that physiologically this is what's happening. And yes, it tips you over, but I don't think that's the mechanism of IBS. I think it's a cofactor.
And also, I think no one would argue with the idea that if you have IBS or SIBO and you do stress control measures, you decrease your stress, you will feel better and, all around, and your digestive symptoms may improve some. Like, stress, as you say, it's a modifier, but, will it cure it? That's going to be rare that I think that would happen, where, you handle your stress.
This is why, if you're doing your favorite thing, you say you have pain in your leg and you're doing your favorite thing, you forget about the pain for a while. Let's say you're playing the piano and you just get into the zone of the piano and you forget about the pain in your leg that you have. That's distraction techniques or mindfulness or whatever you want to call it. It's great. But it's not changing the physiology of what's going on in your body. It's trying to get you to cope, trying to get you. So it's things to allow you to live your life with illness. What we're talking about today is how to cure the illness so you don't have to do all of those things to try and live with it. So yes, there are important things to help you live with it, but why should you live with it?
Great question. Great question. I think we should wrap up on that. There's so much hope. We hope that you all have taken this information and will watch this recording over and over again so you can really absorb it. Talk to your doctors, talk to your clinicians, your practitioners. Absorb the information so that you can turn this learning into your thinking and that you can support your medical practitioners. If they haven't, feel free to share the recording with them. They need it. And
we have lots of practitioners who watch this, of course, too.
Thank you to you all for your commitment to ongoing learning. Yes, cheers to you. Dr. Pimentel, thank you so much for joining us. We can't wait to do it again, and we wish you Godspeed. Thank you, Dr. Seebecker. As always, fantastic questions and a great co-host.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pimentel.
Great talking to you both. Always good questions.
Thank you.